Well, this morning we're looking at our third lesson in the series, 12 Rules for Life. And you remember this was sort of inspired by a book by the same title, which was inspired by a Quora inquiry in which one of the people asked, you know, what do you all think are the most valuable things everyone should know? And I thought, well, I wonder what I would say if somebody asked me that. I wonder what I would tell my kids, my grandkids. If I'm dead, what will the grandkids say? What were grandfather's most important things that everybody should know? And so we talked in the first place about rule number one. Embrace the Christian faith and worship as your only hope for happiness without regret. Because at the end of your life, you're not going to regret that you were a Christian, and all the time between now and then, you have these awesome experiences of feeling the awe of an awesome God. And so here we are talking about the real happiness that's possible in this world. Rule number two, we talked about last week, to habituate a characteristic focus on the things that will matter to you when you die, because your life is a journey and there's a destination, and what you do each day of your journey matters. And if you're just a little bit off over a long period of time, or if you make big course changes in the wrong direction suddenly, then you find yourself at a destination you never wanted to be at. And today, habituate another focus, a characteristic focus on things that are both true and lovely. Now, most of you have heard me address this topic before because I love it very much. So, of course, it has to be in the 12 rules. And I'm going to hopefully elaborate on some of the details that I've never had a chance to talk about before. What is the best tool in the psychologist's workshop? Whatever that is, I think that's very important in an age like ours where depression and anxiety are basically at epidemic proportions. From WebMD, you know the website. It says, this tool works as well or better than medication to treat depression. So whatever works better than medication, I want to know about that. The American Psychological Association says, this tool is as effective as or more effective than other forms of psychological therapy or psychiatric medications. So it's more effective than medication, or at least as effective as medication, and more effective, or at least as effective, as other forms of therapy. This is pretty good stuff, whatever it is. Again, WebMD says, this is the best proven form of psychotherapy. Psychotherapy where you come together with a counselor and you talk. This is the best proven form. Like, wow, okay, I'm interested. Wikipedia, let's see what they say. You know, what's the consensus out there? It is recommended as the first line of treatment. First line of treatment for the majority of psychological disorders in children and adolescents. The first line, where do you start? You start with this. From the Anxiety and Depression Association of America. It says this method is well established, highly effective, and lasting. See, that's important. It really works and it lasts a long time. Wow, okay. National Alliance on Mental Illness. This technique has a considerable amount of scientific data supporting its use. So it's not just hearsay. It's been studied. And from The Coddling of the American Mind, a best-selling book, this technique works about as well as Prozac and similar drugs for relieving the symptoms of anxiety disorders and mild to moderate depression. And it does so with longer-lasting benefits and without negative side effects. The therapy with the strongest evidence that it is both safe and effective. Like, wow, well, whatever this method is, this tool, this therapy, whatever that is, I want to know about that. Well, of course, you've heard of it before. It's called cognitive behavioral therapy. Cognitive because all people who are suffering from anxiety and depression have what might be called automatic thoughts, things that just pop up in your mind, and they produce anxiety and depression. And you counter those in this therapy by focusing on the things that are true and positive. Like, don't think that way. It's not catastrophic. Don't allow yourself to go down that path. And then behavioral, cognitive behavioral therapy, because there are depressant behaviors. So, for example, when you start to feel low and you decide to withdraw from society, that also causes depression. So not only are you depressed in the first place, you have just behaved in a way that makes you more depressed. And so you have a feedback loop. When Teresa's grandfather died, Lucy. Some of you know Lucy, Teresa's grandmother. We called her Mammy. She was in despair. She was a very young widow, and she was sitting all the time in her dark house, all by herself. And one day, Charlie, Teresa's dad, went over there and said, "Mom, you're not going to do this." And he opened all the curtains to let the Arizona sunlight flood in. And he said, "You're going to go out, you're going to be with people, and you're going to get a job, and you can't live like this." And she got a job at like a little Hallmark store. And so people would come in and she would chat with them, sometimes regular customers. She'd get to know people. One day, Liberace came in there and she had a story to tell. "Liberace came in my store today." And she didn't stay in that dark room. That's a depressant behavior. So it's cognitive behavioral therapy. And you have to do right if you want to feel right. So that is the therapy that everybody says works at least as well as medications, maybe better. Works as well as any other psychotherapy, maybe better. It's the first line of defense. Or to say it another way, Philippians 4:8. "Finally, brothers, whatever things are true, honest, just, pure, lovely, of good news, if there is anything that is a virtue, if there is anything that is a praise, think on these things." Think on these things. That's it. That's cognitive therapy. You are not allowed to focus on the things that are negative and the things that are untrue. You have to think on these things. And we'll unpack that a little bit more as we go. But verse 8 is connected to verse 9. And this is where you get the behavioral part of this. You're not allowed to have these habits that lead to depression. What are you supposed to do instead? Verse 9, Paul the apostle says, "Those things which you have learned, do. And if you do, what happens? The God of peace shall be with you." The God of peace. Peace comes if you do what you know you're supposed to do. So you put those together. Think on these things. What you've learned, do. Cognitive behavioral therapy. Here's the surprise. The most effective and cutting-edge approach to psychotherapy today is the same one that Christian teachers and sufferers have relied on since the time of Christ. This is as old as the Christian faith. And surprise again, the Bible actually commands the central practices of cognitive behavioral therapy. The commands were, as you saw, think on these things. That's a command. Think on these things, not those things. Think on these. Let this be your focus. That's a command. And the behavioral part, those things which you have learned, do. So there it is. These are commands. And, of course, the commands are throughout Scripture. There are two key words that I want to especially emphasize in our lesson today from Philippians 4:8. Remember, think on these things, and the list includes, first of all, things that are true, honest, just, pure, lovely. I want to feature true and lovely because that captures so much of what I think we have a problem with in our generation, and of course, all human beings in all generations. Think on these things, the things that are true and the things that are lovely. And truth is always first. It's necessary for truth to be first. The potential of cognitive behavioral therapy can only fully be realized, I believe, in the Christian faith. I recently read an article. It was in the Wall Street Journal, if I remember right. And the headline said that if you don't believe in God, you should still not say that to your kids because it shakes them. It makes a negative difference, so don't tell them. Well, see, the problem with that is you want to have positive thoughts, but if you're not going to think within the parameters of the Christian faith, it's really hard to have positive thoughts. So, for example, is there healing truth in atheism? Well, not if you really are. And these are quotes. If you don't believe that we have a created world, then this is what you believe. That we people are nothing more than stardust accidents living momentarily, not long, we're only here for a blink, right? Living momentarily in a hostile and mostly lifeless cosmos. You get the wrong idea when you're watching all of these science fiction shows. You know, in Star Trek, there's an M-class planet. That means it's like Earth, it's habitable. There aren't any like that. What really happens is if we shot you out into space, you'd be simultaneously frozen, and your organs would shut down after 2 minutes but your skin would also be fried by the UV rays, all at the same time, frozen and fried all at the same time. We have a mostly hostile and lifeless cosmos. So if you don't believe in a creator, then this is your world. You are stardust. You came from an explosion, and you live in a very bad place. If it's postmodernism, remember, postmodernism says, hey, there's no such thing as truth. Maybe to you, 2 + 2 = 4, but to me, 2 + 2 = 5, and I don't want you to tell me any different. That's postmodernism. So is there healing in that? Because we're supposed to say the things that are positive and the things that are encouraging. Is there any truth that we can find in postmodernism? Well, there really isn't any such thing as truth. If really all we have is each person's opinion, what we call your truth, well, that might be your truth, but it's not my truth. What we might call it's true for you, but it's not true for me, then we're at an impasse. How can we speak about positive things when we don't even know if anything's true? So that's a problem. All right, so our two key words, we've talked about true. Now let's talk about lovely. Whatever is lovely, we're supposed to focus on that. That's really, really important. And it's hard for us human beings to do that. The word lovely, as it comes up in the Bible here, Philippians 4:8 is the only place in the whole Bible where this comes up, the word lovely. So we ask ourselves, what are we supposed to think about that's lovely? What's lovely? And we find that the Jewish rabbis talked about Esther's face, you know, Queen Esther, who was famous for her beauty. Queen Esther's face, they say, was cheerful and lovely. Oh, so we think about the things that are lovely, like a lovely face. The rabbis also said, behave yourself pleasantly in the assembly. Oh, so if it's pleasant, that's a lovely face, a pleasant way of life and behavior. And again, the rabbi said, the wise man makes himself beloved through his words. He is endearing himself to others because he uses wise words. That's what the rabbis thought. And so this explanation of lovely here is just what you think it would be when I say the word lovely. And the question then is, can we really focus on the things that are true and lovely? Because is life really true and lovely? Is it? And we want to refer to our previous lessons. Rule number one, there really is pure happiness waiting for us all in heaven. And it's even experienced here in the awe of worship. To know that we are God's special charge, that we have been given so many wonderful blessings and benefits by a heavenly Father. To know that brings a sense of peace and satisfaction in life that no thrill ride at the amusement park could ever bring. And is life really true and lovely? We know that we're going to experience a happy ending at the end of this life when we die, if we are followers of Jesus. And no matter what's going wrong, you know at the end it's going to be lovely. And we can live with a lot of hardship as long as we know it's not permanent, as long as we know there's a payback. And we do know that, and it cheers us when we're going through hardship. And then lastly, is life really true and lovely? Well, we can be impressed by many true and lovely mercies that have been sent to us by God all the time. So it's really important that you realize this is not some mind game that we're playing. Like, you have to tell yourself the things that are true and lovely so many times that you convince yourself of them to lift your mood, and then you wait for reality to jerk the rug out from under you and you lose it all. Like, no, this is true and lovely that is real, and there will never be a rug jerked out from under us. It will never happen because we are truly the children of God, and it's wonderful to live in His presence and to feel His presence every day, and then to die and be in His presence even more tangibly. That's all real. It's all wonderful, and nobody can ever take that away. All right, so we have to apply this to every aspect of our lives now. Let's start with relationships. If you will focus on what is true and lovely, it's going to change every relationship you have. And you think, well, is that important? And yes, relationships are really, really important. Relationships are your true mission in life. that one fellow asked Jesus one day, he said, what is the first and greatest commandment? And Jesus said, to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. And the second best commandment is like it. It is to love your neighbor as yourself. In other words, the whole purpose for you being in this world is to love God and love people. It's your mission. That's really all there is. The purpose of you being in this world is not to eat another steak dinner and brownies and ice cream. That's not enough purpose to be in the world. The purpose for you being in this world is to love God with everything in you and love your neighbor as yourself. That's your mission. So if you get that right, you get everything right. That is the entire story. And relationships are what give your life importance, significance. We yearn to feel like it mattered that we were born. Like, have I made a difference? When I leave here, will anybody care? Does it matter? And it does matter. If you love God with everything in you and love your neighbors yourself, that matters. That's what gives you a sense of importance. All right, so let's talk about marriage. Here's what we teach our children from the cradle. Child, in general, act guardedly. Now, it's one thing, honey, when you're around me, because I love you. But when you go to a job interview, they don't love you. So be careful what you say. Guard your mouth. Be careful what you say. Honey, you're going to go to middle school now. And so you really have to be careful what you say. You can't speak about baby things in middle school. They're not going to understand. They're not going to like you. You have to be on guard. So pay attention. You know, there's cool and there's not cool. And you don't want to spend too long in not cool. You won't have any friends. Be guarded. All right? We know that that's the case. When you make a new friend, even now, you are on guard. Like, I don't just blurt out everything that comes to my mind. I speak and act guardedly. That's what it means to be socially, you know, acceptable. All right. The problem is in marriage, there is no time ever to quit being on guard. Every other relationship we have in the whole wide world will give us frumpy time. Like, frumpy in appearance. I don't know how you feel. When I wake up in the morning, I don't even look like me. Some years back, we went, this is like 2010, we went on a little outing. It was actually at Ray Owens's cottage in North Carolina on the Chesapeake Bay. And a few of us Avalon men went to Ray's cottage. And we stayed up like really, really late. And I can't remember why, but we had to wake up really, really early. And I, for whatever reason, I guess I'm old or something, I was the last one to wake up. Everybody else is up and they're laughing and everything. And I come crawling out of there and my hair is messy and my eyes are all swollen up and everybody laughed at me. They laughed plumb at me. The thing is, in marriage, you wake up like that every day. And there's no time to ever let your guard down. Sometimes your face is just messy. Your hair is messy. And your marriage partner sees it. It's like, can I not be frumpy? I mean, there's never any time to be frumpy around here. And it's not just your face and your hair. It's your personality. We all have off moments and off days. And we're not attractive. Not physically and not in our personalities. And the problem with marriage is your spouse sees you like that all the time. How awful. Well, and that leads us to this problem. We are all flawed enough to be mostly repulsive. You know, if you're going to highlight the flaws, it's going to be bad. We're all embarrassed. We try to, you know, take our best selfies, erase five of them because they look terrible, finally find one that looks decent, put it up. But, I mean, if it was the bad one that your poor spouse had to see all the time, it'd be just terrible. Marriage gives you no downtime. You can't be on guard all the time because you're messy sometimes, messy in heart and messy in appearance. And there's no way to get away, and your poor spouse is stuck with it. So now it becomes a matter of obeying the Scripture. And not just Scripture, but cognitive behavioral therapy. What are you going to focus on? I know what you should focus on. Think on these things, the things that are true, honest, just, pure, and lovely, but we're emphasizing today, true and lovely. What are you going to focus on? So, your wife's pretty face or her cellulite? It's up to you. I'll tell you one thing, if you focus on her cellulite, you're not going to be very happy. You're going to focus on your husband's good handyman skills or his inferior social skills. It's up to you. I know what you're supposed to focus on because I have a Bible verse sitting here that says, whatever things are true and lovely, think on those things. And if you said, I'm not going to think on those things, I'm going to think on the other things, then I think you're not going to like your husband that much. What if we go in a worst case scenario because of age, Alzheimer's, a terrible accident? What if your spouse is profoundly disabled? And as far as anyone knows, will never get better, maybe worse every day. What then? Well, what's left to focus on? Some of you know I have a brother who's very, very disabled. If you want to focus on Mark's weaknesses, you could be very discouraged. When he eats, he doesn't have wonderful table manners. I mean, he's trying, but there's a lack of coordination. He's doing the best he can. If he tells a story, it takes a long time to get the story out. He gets over emotional about certain things that really don't matter. He doesn't understand. He was working at the grocery store, and it's really nice that the grocery store gave him a job, you know. And a guy pulls up right in front of the doors of the grocery store. And Mark is out there getting the carts. And he goes up to the guy and says, hey, you can't park here. This is a no parking area. And the man said, I'll be just a minute. And Mark said, no, you can't park here. And Mark pestered the guy so much that the guy moved. The guy was the manager of the store. A short time after that, Mark was gone. You know, he's doing the best he can. But if you're going to focus on the flaws, the weaknesses, then there's not much to like. And that's true of your spouse. As strange as it sounds, you have to pick out the good things and focus on them. The things that are true and the things that are lovely. And if there is no use for a person in the whole world because he's so disabled or she's so disabled, you know what you have then? You have cosmic importance. That person who cannot speak, who cannot walk, who cannot perhaps even think clearly anymore, that person was loved so much by Jesus that he died on the cross for that person. Now, do you suppose you could help that person feed himself? Could you do that? If you think on the things that are true and lovely, think, yes, if Jesus cared enough to die for this person, I care enough to help him eat his dinner. See, that's how you do it. You focus on the things that are lovely. And that is lovely. Cosmic importance. The Gottman Institute, some of you have heard me talk about this before, is famous for its research-based marriage counseling. And John Gottman says, our motto for making marriage last is small things often, which is very like Philippians 4:8. We're going to think on these things, small good things, and lots of them. We're going to make that our focus. He says, happily married couples noticed almost all the positive things the researchers observed their partners do for them. However, unhappily married couples underestimated their partners' loving intentions by 50%. In other words, when they're counseling these couples, they put them in what they call the love lab, and they have the cameras rolling, and they're looking through one-way glass, and listening to all the conversation, and they have pulse sensors, that sort of thing, so they can, you know, get biofeedback. And they're watching these couples, and the couples that are going to remain happily married, they are noticing, oh, did you see my wife kind of smiled at me a little bit? But the ones who are not going to make it, they didn't notice. There are like these little repair attempts. Excuse me. You reach out and you touch somebody's arm or leg or knee or whatever in marriage. Shouldn't be just touching anybody's knee, okay? So in marriage. And all the researchers, did you see that? She just reached over and touched his knee. That's a plus. They get a point. And then they go ask the people afterwards, did you notice that your wife did anything affectionate while you were having this fight? Like, no, I didn't notice. So it's happening and you didn't notice. In other words, you're not able to focus on it. The small things often that you're focusing on, this is what we need. Here's the problem. If you see, and we all see, I guess, if you see these flaws and then focus on them in marriage, here's what's going to happen. By constantly viewing your wife or your husband at their worst, you're going to start avoiding them, and then you're going to be ashamed of them and sometimes disgusted with them. So that's what happens. If you're going to focus on the negative of your marriage partner, that will be you. And the best spouse in the world, truly the best spouse in the world, still has so many flaws that they could never hold up under the spotlight of criticism. Nobody can. It is absolutely impossible. If my wife were to decide that she was going to start looking at all of my weaknesses, all of my flaws, in a very short time, she couldn't stand to be around me because everybody is that flawed. So you see, you have a choice to make in all relationships. And your command from Philippians 4:8 is, you find about your spouse whatever is true and whatever is lovely, and you focus on it and focus on it and focus on it, because that is how you keep relationships together. Proverbs 10:12. Hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all sins. I love you so I don't even see that you have a pimple on your nose today. It doesn't matter. 1 Peter 4:8. Above all things, have fervent love among yourselves. And here it is. For love shall cover the multitude of sins. Well, yeah, I know that you have wrinkles on your forehead now and other problems, but I still love you. And you're focusing on the good things. I don't even want to see the bad things. I want to find the good things. And there are always good things. 1 Corinthians 13:5. Love thinks no evil. Yeah, you know, you could focus on my flaws, my failures. You could, but I wish you wouldn't. I wish you think about the better things. Love doesn't want to think about what's evil. Micah 6:8. He has shown you, oh man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do righteousness? And I love this phrase. And to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. To just love mercy. Yeah, I know you have a fault. But I just love mercy and I want to overlook your fault. That is how relationships are built and maintained. Well, the same problem happens with child raising. Maybe it's not quite to the same degree, but it's probably about the same. In general, act guardedly, we tell our children, act guardedly. But the thing is, they come home and they let their guard down. Children, excuse me, are always under the microscope, always our microscope. And all children are flawed enough to be repulsive. I read an article sometime back about how big cities in the United States aren't really particularly kid-friendly. You know, so you have apartments with stairs, and there's not a lot of things for the kids to do, no yard, you know, that kind of thing. And he said, I was in the stairwell of our apartment, and I watched this mother dragging a screaming child up the stairs. And he said, it was like a propaganda advertisement for family planning. Like, who wants to do this? And that's true. All kids are so flawed that if we concentrate on their flaws, we can't stand to be around them. And that's true even for parents. Zani explains to Elnor in the TV series Picard why Jean-Luc Picard doesn't like children. He says, why don't you like children? And Zani says, oh, Jean-Luc doesn't like children because they're demanding, distracting, and interfere with duty and pleasure alike. And Jean-Luc Picard just kind of goes, that pretty much nailed it. If that's what you think of kids, you're not going to want to be around the kids. And the thing is, that's true. Captain Hook explains to Maggie and Jack in Disney's movie, The Hook, that her mother doesn't read to her at bedtime because she loves the children. No, child, Your mother wants to read to you every night in order to stupefy you to sleep so that she and daddy could sit down for three measly minutes without you and your mindless, inexhaustible, unstoppable, repetitive, and nagging demands. He took my toy. She hid my bear. I want to potty. I want a cookie. I want to stay up. I want. Me. Mine. Now. Of course, that is what kids do. But children are also the best shot for most people at profoundly influencing someone, even multiple generations in this world, for Jesus. I like to make stuff. I think I might always making something. But what I really want to make is a boy and a girl. They might not even be mine. I had the joy of being at Chick-fil-A a couple nights ago and all these children were performing for me. That's just great. Make whatever you want, but I want to make boys and girls. Thank you, Russ. What I really need is a way to swallow this into my lungs. So I know that would help. All right, so make whatever you want, but I wish that you would make boys and girls. It's your best chance at profoundly influencing someone in this world. And it's your best shot, most people's best shot, not everybody, most people's best shot at experiencing love as the Father loves the Son. You know, the greatest love in the universe is not the mother's love for her baby, but that's pretty great. The greatest love in the universe is God the Father's love for God the Son. That's parent-child. And it's your best shot, most people's best shot, not everyone's, most people's best shot at experiencing truly lifelong one anothering. You know, in the New Testament, we have all those one another texts. You're supposed to encourage one another. You're supposed to care for one another. You're supposed to teach one another. All of those things, one another. That's the way the New Testament reads. And for most people, your best shot at lifelong, that is from the cradle to the grave, one anothering is going to take place in the context of parent-child relationships. And it's so weird that when our children are little, they can't walk very well, so we hold their hands. And then when we get to be 85 years old, we can't walk very well, so our children hold our hands so we don't tip over. It's one anothering from the cradle to the grave. It tends to happen in the context of family. And so you say, well, those children are demanding and distracting from duty and pleasure alike. That's true. But look what you're missing if you don't have them. If you don't have them and you also don't reach out to others' children. And this is the crazy part. For most of us, children are our best shot at having our horrific, natural selfishness deeply challenged. Jay Budziszewski, professor, he says, offspring convert us. They force us to become different beings. There's no way to prepare for them completely. They crash into our lives. They soil their diapers. They upset all our comfortable living arrangements. And nobody knows how they will turn out. Willy-nilly, they knock us out of our complacent habits and force us to live outside of ourselves. You're going to become a better person because you invested in children. So you say, well, they're demanding and distracting both in duty and pleasure. That's true. But these are the things you're going to miss. Here's the problem then, same as before. We see the flaws of our children. Now, if we focus on their flaws, if we let that be our focus, we're not going to think on the good things that are lovely. We're going to think on the things that are bad. If we focus on them, then here's what's going to happen. We're going to start avoiding our children. We're going to be ashamed of them in public places particularly. And we're going to be disgusted by them. And these are the very things that cause all the childhood trauma that we hear so much about. Focus on the things that are true and lovely in all relationships. This is the magic that makes some people able to lift others wherever they go. They are going to light up the room wherever they go. And it's because they have learned to focus on the things that are true and lovely about all people in all relationships. This is it. This is the magic. Think on these things, the true and lovely things. Learn to love mercy, like Micah says. Let your love compel you to think no evil, like 1 Corinthians 13 says. Let your love cover a multitude of sins in two separate passages and focus on the small good things often. This is what you must do to make your relationships healthy. Agnostic fellow A.J. Jacobs wrote a book called living biblically, and he wanted to see if for 1 year he could live like the Bible said a person should live. And of course, he didn't try just everything, but he said on the subject of lying and gossiping and no coveting, he would try to do that. He says, no lying, no gossiping, no coveting. He says, I'm a journalist in New York. That's like 70% of my day. So he said, I forced myself to stop gossiping, and eventually I started to have fewer petty thoughts to gossip about. You see that? You are going to say, we're not going to do this anymore. I'm going to think about better things. And the next thing you know, you have the feedback loop. My behavior has changed. My thoughts have changed, which also changes my behavior, which also changes my thoughts. And around we go. Remember, there's a two-part test for every word you ever speak. Is it true? Is it lovely? Both of those have to be in place. What you say must be true, and what you say must be lovely. The person with a terribly disfigured face, I guess most of you know I have a terribly disfigured right hand. I mean, I don't mind if you talk about it. I'm glad to talk about it. My grandkids talk about it all the time. It's okay. I mean, I really don't mind. But in some cases, it's embarrassing. And people who have children with problems, they're offended because they go in public and somebody says, oh, don't stare. A mother with a disfigured child doesn't want you to refrain from staring. The mother with a disfigured child wants you to come up and say hi. You know? Nobody in his right mind would focus on the poor child's disability or his disfigurement. I mean, who would do that? That would be such a terrible idea. And if a person who had, let's say, a disfigured face, had every person who ever saw him come up and say, oh, I see you have a disfigured face, it's going to break him down. Now, it's going to make the speaker weird. Oh, I see you have a disfigured face. It makes you weird, and it makes the hearer feel awful. So before you say something, make sure it's not only true, hey, you have a disfigured right hand. Hey, you have a disfigured face. Make sure it's not just true, but also lovely, lovely and kind. If it doesn't pass both tests, then it's not appropriate. And so the things that are true and the things that are lovely, we think on these things. We focus on these things. And these are the things that come out in our speech. Remember, don't simply hold your tongue, change your focus. What we want you to do is find the true and lovely things about that person. Find those. When you find those, then the bad thoughts are going to be squashed away. And now the words that come out of your mouth will be true and lovely, not because you learned to hold your tongue in public, but because you're actually thinking true and lovely thoughts. You're focusing on those things that will come out in your speech. This is going to change your relationships. If you do this, it's going to change your emotional wellness and your spiritual integrity. Think on these things, the things that are true, the things that are lovely. You must, it's a command. Think on these things. Find that focus. Focus on true and lovely things will make you feel lucky. It will make you feel grateful. If you focus on the things that are true and lovely in your life, you're going to feel lucky. People who are feeling lucky at this very moment are not at this very moment also feeling anxious, depressed, or angry. Lucky people never feel that way. So if you feel lucky, if you feel, and by the way, you see in quotes, if you feel grateful, if you're focusing on the things that make you feel lucky, then you're not going to have so many problems, which is why this psychotherapy is recommended everywhere. Your main emotion, remember, even God has mixed emotions, right? And I expect you would have mixed emotions. I'm sure I do. God both loves and he hates. God both rejoices and he grieves. God is both at peace and he is angry. But what you notice is God is not characterized by hate. For example, we say God is love. We know that God does hate, but God is not hate. God is love. And he has a layer of hate that is not the dominant layer of his emotional state. We would not say Jesus, who is called the Prince of Peace, we wouldn't say, but he's the Prince of Anger. Like, no, that's not right. God has anger. Jesus has anger. Jesus is the Prince of Peace. He's not the Prince of Anger, because anger is a lesser emotion. There's a layer of anger in God. But mostly, God is love. Jesus is the Prince of Peace. The fruit of the Spirit is love and joy and peace. This is God's dominant emotion. And that is how you should be too. We're not saying that nothing bad has happened in your life. Nothing that should make you feel sad, worried, or angry. We're not saying that. We're saying you can't let those things dominate your emotions. You say, well, I can't control my emotions. Yes, you can. That's what we're talking about today. You can control your focus, and that's the very important thing. By using focus, we have remarkable control over our mood, over our emotions, which is why this psychotherapy is so helpful. Earl Nightingale says, we become what we think about most of the time, and that's the strangest secret. That's a very important quote. I don't know if he considered himself to be a Christian, but in our understanding of Scripture, we become what we think about most of the time, and that's the strangest secret. If my wife were to think about my flaws, most of the time she couldn't stand to be around me. If you were to look at your kids' flaws, most of the time you couldn't stand to be around them. But if you'll change your focus, and you can change your focus, if you start looking for the lovely things, that's going to turn everything around. Seeing what is really true and lovely is not, as I said, a mind game that we're just playing on ourselves. There are really true and lovely things. You know, the God of our faith really does have special warmth for the underdog. So if you consider yourself to be the underdog, you know where you are. You're given special consideration by God. People who live in a way that increases God's reputation in the world really are helping to save the world. How would you like that for your job? Save the world. Yes, I help save the world. That's what you're doing when you love boys and girls. That's what you're doing when you have a good influence for Jesus. You're saving the world. That's the best thing any person could ever do. You're like a superhero. Those who follow Jesus really do have a happy ending waiting for them just around the corner. That's true. It really is true. So we have to force our thoughts to recount all that is true and lovely in our lives over and over again, every day, every hour if necessary. You force your thoughts there. And as I have said on other occasions, take your cues from your disorders. You feel anxious? That's the time to refocus your thoughts and especially pray. Philippians 4:6 says, be anxious for nothing. Stop worrying. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer. Oh, you feel a worry coming on? Okay, just pray real quick. You say, well, that worry comes upon me 10 times in an hour. Good. Pray a quick prayer 10 times in an hour. In everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving. Oh, so make sure that when you pray your quick prayer 10 times an hour, there's thanksgiving. So, Lord, I have a problem, but I understand you are the one with the solution, and actually, this ice cream is very good. Thanksgiving. A quick prayer, lots of thanksgiving. And if you do that, the peace of God that passes understanding will be yours. Here again, in rapid succession, ready to go through a lot of Bible verses in 3 minutes. Here we go. An intentional focus on giving thanks. Ooh, I'm starting to worry. I'm starting to feel depressed. Oh no. What shall I do? Focus on giving thanks. 1 Thessalonians 5:18. In everything, give thanks. Ephesians 5:20. Giving thanks always for all things. Hebrews 13:15. By him, therefore, let us offer the sacrifice of praise to God continually. That is the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name. We're going to focus on the things we're thankful for. Take your cue from your depression and learn the music of the lucky ones. I'm talking about praise music. The people who feel lucky praise God. And the praises make them feel lucky. If they quit praising, they wouldn't feel lucky. Focus on praise. I'm not feeling good. I feel anxious. I feel angry. I feel so depressed. All right, time to learn the songs. You know the songs? Learn the songs. Psalm 71:6, you have to praise the Lord. My praise shall continually be of you. Psalm 71:8, let my mouth be filled with your praise and with your honor all the day. I'm going to give you lots of praises throughout the day. Lord, you're so good. You've made this world so pretty, and you've given me this nice house. Lots of praises. Psalm 71:14. I will hope continually and will yet praise you more and more. I'll praise you tomorrow more than I did today. Psalm 119:164. 7 times a day I'll praise you. You've just always been good to me. Psalm 145:2. Every day I'll bless you. I'll praise your name forever and ever. Psalm 34:1. I'll bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. I'll think about this all the time. Psalm 113, verse 3. From the rising of the sun to the going down of the same, the Lord's name is to be praised. From sunrise to sunset, I'll focus my thoughts on lots of great things you've done for me. Psalm 149:3. Let them praise his name. Let them sing praises to him. Let the saints sing aloud even when they're on their beds. Even when it's time to go to sleep, praise the Lord again. Hebrews 13:15, same thing. By him, therefore, let us offer the sacrifice of praise to God continually. Psalm 57:7. My heart is fixed, O God. My heart is fixed. I am determined. I will sing and give praise. I'm feeling a little depressed right now. I'm feeling a little angsty right now. But I am determined. I'm going to praise you. And when you focus on the things that are true and lovely, next thing you know, your mood is lifted. Vanitha Reisner is so good. I've read you this quote before, but I want to highlight certain things. Almost every line is important. She is a polio victim. She has the kind of polio that has confined her to a wheelchair, and it also causes her great pain. In addition, her baby was born with a birth defect, and he died. He had a heart birth defect, and he died. And additionally, when all that hardship started happening, her husband bailed and left her alone. Lots and lots of hardship. She said, counting my miseries seems to shrink my soul. See, that's the opposite of counting your blessings. I'm counting my miseries. And how did that make you feel? Oh, it made me feel like my soul was shrinking. Counting my miseries seems to shrink my soul. And in the end, I am more miserable than I was when I began. Rather than dwelling on the negative, see, think on these things, not those things, not the negative, the things that are true and lovely. I'm not going to dwell on the negative. Rather than dwelling on the negative, I begin praying that God will use it in my life for others involved to his glory. This is not an easy prayer. I don't really feel like it sometimes. I'm feeling depressed. I'm feeling anxious, worried. I'm feeling angry. I don't feel like praying. This is not an easy prayer. It is a deliberate choice. You see, focus, focus, focus. It is a deliberate choice to push worry, anger, and self-pity away. But as I seek the Lord and keep talking to him, focus, focus, focus. As I seek the Lord and keep talking to him, he enables me to take my thoughts captive. Slowly, here it is, my sense of desperation dissipates. Now that lady has real problems. She's saying this is her strategy. Not only is she saying this is her strategy, this is the entire New Testament strategy. And not only that, social science has stumbled onto it, and they say it's the most effective strategy in the psychologist's workshop at this very moment. This is your life. So the core question was, what are the most valuable things that everyone should know? And I hope you always live by rule number 3. Habituate a characteristic focus on things that are both true and lovely. I'd like for you to bow your heads and close your eyes. If there's anything that comes to your mind as you think about habituating a characteristic focus on things that are true and lovely. Have you been doing that? Have you been doing that for your poor spouse? Have you been doing that for your children? Have you been doing that in every relationship? Because if you haven't, this is your calling. You have to do this. And if you've never yet given Jesus your heart, maybe you haven't been realizing how wonderful he is to you. Maybe in this moment of silence, you'll come to Jesus right now and say, I've been thinking negatively about you, Lord, but I'm not going to think that way anymore. I get it. I believe in you. I want to follow you. And I hope you'll do that if you haven't already done that.